This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. As Hurricane Michael slammed into the panhandle, campaigning for the midterm elections, for the most part, took a pause while state, city and county leaders focused on storm preparation. Now the focus is on helping the communities which bore the brunt of the huge storm rebuild. Democrat Andrew Gillum's running mate in the race for the governor's mansion is Orlando businessman and former primary rival Chris King. King stopped by WMFE's studios last Thursday for a conversation about the campaign. He began by talking about Hurricane Michael and the recovery effort.
This was one of the strongest storms to hit this area in over, I think, a century.
Sure.
And so we took it very seriously. Mayor Gillum took it very seriously, and I'm very proud of the leadership he has shown and will show in the days ahead in rebuilding his community.
It is a fact, though, in the state of Florida, any state, I guess, which has to deal with weather events or other kind of natural hazards, how somebody behaves in a leadership position in the face of those hazards is kind of a test of leadership. I mean, that's kind of the test of how gubernatorial you can be, right?
I think it is. I think it's a great test because it's almost like politics aside. This isn't right or left, Republican or Democrat. This is how does someone really show good judgment, good wisdom, good character? How do they communicate to people in a way in real time that makes sense, that helps not only save lives, but protect property and protect communities? And I think we've oftentimes in these very unusual events, we're able to see the test and the mettle of the men and women who are in service. And I think Mayor Gillum yesterday really distinguished himself. And I think people all over the state of Florida are talking about that today.
Chris King, I want to ask then about some of the other issues that are front and center for Floridians. One of the things, especially here in the I-4 corridor, is transportation. There's a lot of construction on I-4 through the center of Orlando, of course, downtown Orlando. That's been underway for a couple of years. There's still more to go there. It's lengthened commute times. There is SunRail, but the schedule there isn't particularly frequent. What are the options for people who aren't able to drive or can't or need some mass transit? And if you and Mayor Gillum are successful in your candidacy in this election, what are you going to be able to do to boost those kind of mass transit options for Floridians?
This is a huge issue for Florida. It's a huge issue in the I-4 corridor, and Mayor Gillum and I are talking about it a lot. One is, you know, we both agree completely that one of the worst decisions that our local and statewide leaders made was in 2010, 2011, when Rick Scott said no to building a high-speed rail between Orlando and Tampa. I think that decision has exacerbated these transportation challenges. We are, of course, in favor of rail and other forms of transportation. We can't build roads fast enough with the way Florida's growing. One. Two, housing. Housing contributes so much to our transportation challenges. Workers are having to travel an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours between their home and their job, this congests our roads. And so affordable housing, more affordable housing, is a passion of Mayor Gillum and myself. We have a plan to fix it. And in Central Florida and in Tampa Bay, where we have this I-4 corridor, it's one of our strongest and toughest economic challenges.
What about high-speed rail then? Because that has been on the table in the past. It got taken off the table. And then most recently, the state started taking bids for private companies to get that high-speed rail project underway. What do you think about that?
That's really the irony is folks say, are you in favor of high-speed rail? Absolutely. But the deal that was on the table in 2010-11 is not there. So we're building slower trains for more money today. Sure, we've got to look at all of those options, and there are a number of public-private partnerships that are forming across the state to try to fill this vacuum because of our decision almost 10 years ago now to say no to billions of dollars in federal support to build a first-class, innovative rail corridor here in Central Florida. And so we're going to be looking at those things. We're going to be trying to understand the financial realities and where the resources would come from. We don't have the opportunity we had almost a decade ago, but we're very open to that.
And of course, the argument you'll hear from Governor Scott is that he rejected those funds because he said that wasn't paying the full picture. That would have cost taxpayers a lot more than the money that was coming down from the federal government. Do you accept that?
Ironically, even in this election year, as he's running for Senate, he has now seemingly changed his approach in mind and is coming out more in favor of some of these public-private partnerships around rail, which I think suggests to me that he recognizes roads and cars are not just the future of transportation. We've got to be thinking like some of the other states around the country much more strategically if we're ever going to get ahead of this.
Chris King, back to your comment about housing, what are some of the specifics of getting some more affordable housing built? Because if you look at Orlando, for example, there are projects that the city is running to get some affordable housing built. It's a lot of money, though, and it takes a long time to get, you know, just some units that people need, and there's a long waiting list when those units get built because there are so many people who do have that need. So how would you accelerate that process?
The state can do so much more. Andrew Gillum winning this election would allow us to do something we haven't done well in 20 years. So the last Democratic governor we had was Lawton Chiles in the 90s. He started something called the Sadowski Housing Trust Fund, which created really substantial resources for housing, for first-time home ownership, for rental housing, workforce, seniors, veterans housing. And it started. And it was very successful, and it's provided a lot of the housing across the state of Florida. The problem is over the last 15, 20 years, our Republican governors have been raiding money from that fund and not using it for housing. Almost $2 billion have been raided from that fund, and that has created real problems in affordable housing in Florida. Mayor Gillum has said he will not sign a budget in Florida that raids $1 from that fund. And what that would allow us to do is invest nearly $1 billion in public and private monies in solving our housing crisis. And that's something I think the other side in this election doesn't even talk about.
But you do hear from Republicans that they agree that raiding the fund is a bad idea. I mean, it's not just Democrats you hear saying we've got to protect this money because it's an important fund and affordable housing is a crisis.
We do now, but it was Republicans for 20 years that raided $2 billion. Remember, they had the governor's mansion, they had the House, they had the Senate. So their hands, their fingerprints are all over those raids. I've talked to many of them directly about that. They are responsible. It was one of the worst economic decisions that was made in the last 20 years. And so what we're facing right now from unions to the state chamber of commerce, they're saying housing is becoming one of our central crises, really impacting the future of our economy. And we're the only people running for statewide office in this gubernatorial election that have a plan to fix it.
Let me ask you about gun safety. Obviously, Orlando was the site of, until the mass shooting in Las Vegas happened, it was the site of the worst mass shooting in modern United States history. There's been a lot spoken about it, a lot of ideas about how to make things safer for people. You came out with some ideas on the campaign trail when you were campaigning for governor in the primary. One of them, attacks on bullets. Mm-hmm. Is that something that's still on the table? Could you make that happen?
Sure. So Governor or Mayor Gillum, I'm already thinking ahead to him winning this election, and I are coming together and bringing our ideas together. And I think he's shown tremendous courage when it comes to taking on gun safety and standing up to the NRA, twice standing up to the NRA in court and being successful in Tallahassee. And so there are a number of things we want to do. We want to ban assault weapons. We want to provide universal background checks here in Florida. We want to ban high-capacity magazines. We, of course, won't be taking any money from the NRA now or in the time in the future. And I think all of those things are about creating a different culture around gun safety. Some of the ideas I raised in the primary, you know, that's one thing about not winning in the primaries. You now have a boss, and he will ultimately determine those ideas that move forward. But I think universal background checks, a ban on assault weapons, will be two of the big ideas we're proposing as we advance.
Have you thought about if you win, how you would get that through? Because you would likely be working with a Republican legislature, and this is such a polarizing issue. How do you get those ideas through? How do you sort of build bipartisanship around it?
It is. Well, I think there is a growing culture of bipartisanship around these issues, as evidenced by the fact this past year, the legislature for the first time in a very long time passed a gun safety measure here in the state of Florida. Now, it wasn't perfect. We liked some things in it. We didn't like other things.
Are you talking about the raising the age of purchase for
that's
certain
right.
weapons?
I'm talking about the legislation that was passed after Parkland. And it was something that most people in the NRA said was never going to happen in Florida, and yet it got through in a bipartisan way. And so we recognize this won't be easy, but whether legislatively or through the amendment process in Florida, which is the way we sometimes do hard things that the voters are for, but obstinate politicians are against, we generally can go to that process as well. So we're going to look at all of our options and make the best decision for the people of Florida.
One more question, if I could, Chris King. What's your outreach to recent arrivals from Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. folks who've come over since the devastation from Hurricane Maria more than a year ago now hit Puerto Rico? What do you say to those potential new voters that would make it a good reason to vote for Andrew Gillum and Chris King rather than Ron DeSantis and Jeanette Nunez?
Well, our outreach has been extensive. We're very proud to have been endorsed in this election by the governor of Puerto Rico, who believes we are the best ticket to take Florida forward for the Puerto Rican community. We've been endorsed by huge numbers of Puerto Rican elected officials across the state of Florida. We are in Hispanic churches. We are having roundtables in the Hispanic community, listening, communicating, connecting. And we think we are the best ticket. Affordable housing is a huge issue. Access to health care in a state where 2.5 million people don't have a doctor who knows their name. We have a plan to fix that. The other side does not. Public education, which is a huge issue for the Puerto Rican and Hispanic community. Mayor Gillum is an outspoken champion of it. We're running against somebody who doesn't care very much for public education and has not come forward with ideas to invest new dollars in it. And so on a whole host of issues. And I think the last thing where I have really loved connecting and communicating and serving the Puerto Rican and Hispanic community is this is a very entrepreneurial community. And they want a governor and a lieutenant governor who believe in growing our economy and in helping small businesses, helping homegrown businesses, helping entrepreneurs. I am an entrepreneur by background. And so whether it's education, workforce development, access to capital, this is the ticket that's going to best serve that community.
And just on that note, I mean, the Florida economy is doing pretty well. Unemployment is low. This has all happened under a Republican governor and a Republican legislature in the last few years. So you might argue, and whether you're a Puerto Rican voter, whether you're not a Puerto Rican voter, the state is doing pretty good. So why would they change tack and go for a Democrat?
Well, I would say it's a mixed bag. Yes, our unemployment level is low. But also true is one out of every two jobs pays less than $15 an hour. And also true is of the 10 most populated states, we are last in wages, incomes, and per capita GDP. So what that means, if you blend all that together, it means there are a lot of people out there working, but they're working in poverty. And so Mayor Gillum and I are running to build a more fair economy where more families are experiencing prosperity and the benefits and really able to support themselves. That's why we're talking about housing and health care. That's why we're talking about living wages and raising the minimum wage. Those are all issues our opponents don't want to talk about and don't seem to have a problem with. But for us, those are the people we're seeking to serve.
Chris King, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Matthew.
Orlando businessman Chris King is Democrat Andrew Gillum's running mate in the race for the governor's mansion. And we've reached out to Republican Ron DeSantis' campaign for governor to invite his running mate Jeanette Nunez for an interview on Intersection. Still to come.
We do it right in Florida. We balance our budget. We work with term limits. We work across the aisle because of that balanced budget amendment.
State Representative Mike Miller wants to flip Florida's 7th congressional district from blue to red. He's running against incumbent Stephanie Murphy, who's finishing up her first term as congresswoman. Miller joins us for a conversation about taking what he's learned in Tallahassee to the nation's capital, focusing on the economy, education, and healthcare. That's ahead when Intersection continues. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Republican Mike Miller wants to flip Florida's 7th congressional district from blue to red. He's running against incumbent Stephanie Murphy, who's finishing up her first term as congresswoman. Miller says he's learned how to balance the budget and work across the aisles as a state representative. He now wants to take that approach to Washington, D.C. Miller joins us for a conversation about his priorities in this campaign, focusing on the economy, education and healthcare, and reducing the influence of the federal government. Well, Mike Miller is a Republican. He is the state representative for Central Florida's House District 47. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, really happy to be here, Matthew. Thank you.
What is it that made you want to run for Florida's Congressional District 7?
Yeah, thank you for, first of all, thank you for having me again. And then also, I think that's it's the perfect question to ask me because it's what I've been trying to do my whole life. And that is, you know, from the time I grew up and my parents told me to try to be a man for others, I've always done that. I moved here to Central Florida 25 years ago and, you know, got involved in Little League and started working on the Winter Park Housing Authority, started doing historic preservation stuff in the city of Winter Park. And I just always wanted to be a part of the community and give back. I had the great honor of being elected in the State House for the last two terms, and I really learned a lot in that. And that's what's driving me to run for Congress. I learned in the State House, I learned that we do it right in Florida. We balance our budget. We work with term limits. We work across the aisle because of that balanced budget amendment. It forces everybody to come to the table and make tough decisions because it's our constitutional obligation. And if you notice, most of the budgets in Florida get passed overwhelmingly, Republican and Democrat, because we work together to try to make that the best budget we can for the folks in Florida.
So having been in Tallahassee for a couple of terms, is that enough? I mean, do you feel like you've accomplished enough in your time there?
Well, I mean, listen, it is always a challenge to go through the maze of government. But I can tell you from my 4 years in the Florida House, one of the challenges we have in Florida is all of the federal mandates, all of the downward pressure from the federal government. It's the founding fathers, the states founded the federal government, not the other way around. And I think, you know, what I'm seeing now is that the federal government has taken over such an overwhelming role in everybody's life. And to run a state government effectively, you have a lot of pressure. I looked at the budget in Florida, and I would look at all of these things and say, where did they come from? Well, that's a federal mandate. We have to provide this. We have to provide that. Now, I'm not saying all of them are wrong, but it's a disproportionate amount of things that are downward pressure.
So what are some of the things that the federal government should not be exerting pressure on the state of Florida about?
I think one of them is education. I think, you know, we talk about this a lot. I know you talk about it a lot on your programs. You know, the federal government should not have a role in the state's education system. I think we have to be, and this is, again, back to competition amongst the states. We want to provide the best possible education for our students, K through 12 and all the way through the higher education system, because we subsidize that with taxpayer money. We want these kids to get a good education, especially if they stay here and go to a college. And we want them to stay here and work. And we want to be able to get that the reward of investing in these young men and women by having them stay and get good jobs in Florida. So I think that's really if you would call it almost a closed system, a circular system, that could benefit Florida. And we are doing it. We are actually doing very well. And the less we have the federal government telling us what to do and how to do it, I think it's better.
So are you saying that there isn't really a place for the Federal Department of Education?
I think in some role, the Federal Department of Education, I think, is there because, I mean, it's and sadly, it's what happens with government all over the world. Government has a tendency to grow. It becomes its own worst enemy. But in the Department of Education, I think there's still probably challenges. You know, we have with disabled children, with special needs, with unique populations. Those are probably roles that the federal government can help mm-hmm. offset some of the challenges because it's very cost effective. I mean, very cost heavy and a bigger challenge. But it should be very limited. It should be very, very limited.
It does seem a little counterintuitive, though, Mike Miller, to say, I believe in less government, so therefore I'm running for it.
Yeah, listen. As a member of Congress, you know, we are given a charge to go to Washington, and I'm so blessed to live in Florida, and I'm happy. I would like to stay in Florida. I would go up there and do my job and come home. But I do think, yes, I think the idea to go to Washington and government, like we talked about, it has a tendency to grow on its own. It has a tendency to keep, you know, we have all these agencies and they put out, I don't know if you look at the Federal Registry every day, but it's amazing how many things are put out by agencies which have the effect of law. And it's become this monster, if you will. So I think my role in going to government is to say, let's slow down. Let's slow down first, do no harm to the states. And then let's also look at this spending, because year over year spending with $20 trillion in debt, We have a looming crisis. And someday, somewhere, that there's going to be a call to action to say, okay, we have to start paying off this debt, especially if interest rates increase and we have, you know, God forbid, we have another recession or another calamity where we have this giant debt hanging over our heads. That could be our kids, grandkids paying that off. It shouldn't be that way.
The national debt gone up since the most recent administration was elected, though?
It has been going up since World War II. I don't know when the last time we used to enact debt to try to get to save the planet with World War II, and now we've sort of gotten into this operation where we just keep spending. And I think it really does start with the budget. In the state of Florida, we balance the budget. We make tough decisions. In the federal government, they start out in deficit spending, and it just keeps rolling every year, and that's sort of become the norm. Mm-hmm. That would be one of the things you talked about. You know, why go to D.C. and try to do less? That's a good idea. Less spending would be we would actually try to get our debt in order, and then you can't pay off $20 trillion overnight, clearly, but you got to get on a trajectory to get there, and it would start with trying to balance the budget this year, next year, the year after, and then take the excess. If we can give it back in a tax cut, great, but at the same time, let's try to pay down the debt.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to State Representative Mike Miller. He's running for Congress in House District 7. One of the other key issues is jobs, right? That's a big deal. And you can break that down several ways. You can look at, for example, wages and salaries. What would you be able to do as congressperson? What would you want to do if you're elected to Congress to help stimulate economic growth, help develop the kinds of jobs in Central Florida that people need and want?
Well, and that's one of the reasons I'm running for Congress, not in an open seat. I mean, Congresswoman Murphy is currently the representative in District 7, mm-hmm. and we had a tax reform package that went through Congress, and she voted against the tax reform. And I will tell you with certitude, you look after that tax reform package happened, we have had 4% growth in our economy. We have record employment now, especially when you talk about record employment for minorities like Hispanics and African Americans. It's been fantastic. The lowest unemployment we've had since 1969. It's because of the federal tax reform that has going on.
That surely is not the only reason for it. I mean, some of these trends take a long time to develop.
I would argue that it's accelerated it significantly, and I would argue that that idea, what you talked about with jobs, is paramount to all of it. Government doesn't create jobs. We create the environment. We create the environment that allows a business owner or somebody who wants to start a business to invest in people. And what you're watching happen right now is because of the economic growth, people are hiring more employees. And then here's the thing about Central Florida that's really critical is we have a large service population. It's what we do. We bring tourists in. But now you can see what's happening. Disney has voluntarily gone ahead and said, we are going to raise the minimum wage to $15. It's because of the market forces. It's because we have said, you know, we are going to create a stable environment where you can invest in your workers. And Disney made the decision with the union input, and it was done with market forces.
Disney is one. It's a pretty big company.
Sure.
Granted, it's a huge company in Central Florida, big influence. So the fact that they are saying, yes, we're going to raise starting wages to $15 an hour
is
good.
Yeah.
But why not just have that across the board? Why not have a $15 minimum wage across the board?
Because my big fear in that would be rather than pay somebody $15 an hour, they would cut employees you wouldn't be paying more people $15, you'd be paying less to $15.
Places where they've actually enacted a minimum wage like that, though?
I can't speak to a specific example, but that would be the common sense thing where I, a business owner, I would say, well, shoot, I have to pay somebody $15 an hour, I'll just pay that one and not three people or whatever the terms would be at current market forces. And actually, the other piece to that, which is very important for your listeners and everybody to understand, the minimum wage is really a starting wage. We call it a minimum wage, but it's a starting wage. And you would hope, and this is the other thing about what's happening in our marketplace today, is because we have pretty much full employment, if you want to keep a good employee, you better pay them more because he or she now has three or four job opportunities, whereas you were before having to go struggle to find a job. So that market force in and of itself will take that starting wage higher because I think that's a natural course. And then if you are in a starting wage job and you're getting frustrated with that pay, you go find another job. And there's hundreds of thousands of jobs in the United States right now that are going unfilled because there's not enough workers to fill them.
What about healthcare? What are your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act, and what would you do as congressperson to ensure that people have access to good healthcare in Florida?
again, back to why I think it's a great experience to be in the Florida House. We worked on a bill, which I was a co-sponsor of, actually the prime co-sponsor of, to work on direct primary care. And I believe it's really important when we get back to what real healthcare is. It's actually a doctor and a patient knowing each other, working together, and trying to get to a place where we're doing preventative care rather than just getting sick or going to the hospital. Mm-hmm. We have lost that. And then we have this entire conversation going on about insurance. And all. Really what needs to happen is we need to do what the bill I passed is, which creates a doctor-patient relationship, a contract, if you will, not going through insurance, to provide – it can be means-tested – to provide real authentic healthcare. And then if they find out, you know, God forbid, that they have cancer or something like that, we should have a catastrophic healthcare system, not a healthcare system that covers, or health insurance, excuse me, that covers everything. It should be okay. If you can afford insurance, you should be able to pay it in the private marketplace. If you have a catastrophic situation, that's what insurance should be used for. And then we also have a piece of the puzzle that's being underutilized in our country, and that's health savings accounts. I think that's a very powerful way to put money aside, non-taxed to help with those, which should be a preventive maintenance situation. If we got into that situation, I think the entire cost of healthcare would go down. And that's really what we need to talk about. We need to talk about true cost in healthcare and then trying to get to a place where we have a preventive maintenance system instead of a sick care system.
Right. But if you don't have health insurance, then you aren't going to get things treated that you should, and then you can end up in a crisis, right? I mean, that's what happens.
Well, I think, if a doctor is able to go and advertise that, you know, for whatever the fee is that you can afford, we can have a relationship and we can start working on some of your ailments or some of your long-term situations, that is what we need to get to. Right now, everybody's trying to swim around and grab insurance, and we've seen what's happened in the private marketplace. Insurance has gone up, and we're trying to offset it with federal monies to pay for, you know, the Obamacare mandates. It's become a system that has too many strings to it. It really needs to be centralized down to the doctor-patient relationship, to health savings accounts, and to catastrophic insurance.
Would you say then, if you centralize it, could it be a government-run health system?
I would be terrified of a government-run health system, because I think that would get us into a whole nother situation of cost management from a federal government side, which would clearly lead to more healthcare, less quality. And God forbid, we'd end up having situations where people couldn't get access to healthcare because it would just take too long. We'd have lines. We'd have socialized medicine, which I just cannot see in this day and age working in a population like the United States. It just wouldn't work.
Is it just because it's the United States? Because it does work in other countries.
I would argue that. I would argue it works in other countries. And I would say while our healthcare system right now is not working at maximum efficiency, if you let market forces start to work in the healthcare system and you start to let doctors get back to what they truly do, and that is provide medical care and not have to figure out how to get reimbursements and how to get all these things that are in the back of the house, I think you'd see – one of the most important things we need to do is we need to inspire our doctors to want to be in healthcare. We want to get our best and brightest, not to go to Wall Street necessarily, but to go to medical school. And one of the fears I have is we still have the greatest healthcare system in the country
and one of the in the world
in the world, excuse me. But we have challenges, and that's one of the great things about the conversations we have in government and the conversations we have in public. And that is, how do we make it better? And my idea would be to focus on the doctor patient relationship.
I want to ask about national security, because that is something that, as a member of Congress, you would be thinking about. What is your solution for border security, immigration, other aspects of security?
You know, I think one of the best remedies for national security is a strong economy. Because when you have a strong economy, you can afford to pay for a strong military. And when you have a strong economy, you're able to help countries that maybe have, you know, we have a crisis on the southern border right now because of the calamities in El Salvador and Honduras with unstable governments. And I don't blame somebody who's in a terrifying situation, and maybe their husband was taken away or murdered, or what God forbid what happened, you know, is something that's caused them to leave their home, walk 1,000 miles to the United States border and try to find asylum. A strong economy in the United States makes a stronger economy for the world, and I think that would help some of these places in the world that are going through a lot of economic strife.
Okay, final question then. I want to ask about gun safety, because, of course, Central Florida was, until fairly recently, tragically the site of the worst mass shooting in recent U.S. history, until Las Vegas. What would your strategy be then to look at that issue and try and bring about some change there?
Well, You know, I went to the dedication of the memorial there at the Pulse site, and I was very proud of Earl Crittenden, the chairman of the board there, and he called it what it was. He called it a terrorist act, and it really was. You know, he had pledged allegiance to ISIS on the phone there, or whoever he was talking to, police, and then obviously did this horrific tragedy. So there is a challenge with that. That's a terrorist act. And then we also, because I was in the legislature during the Parkland shooting, went through that experience. And that, what a catastrophic failure that was to let that young man get to the point where he was going to take some beautiful children's lives and the workers at the school. So that particular case in Parkland, and that's something that I would look at on a national level, is we have to start talking about the mental health situation where young men are at that point where they think they could do harm to others. And we have to make sure that in the mental health world that there is safeguards in place that somebody who is mentally ill has no way to get access to a firearm, to a weapon. I would work on that on the federal level for sure. That the mental health situation, especially with young men that are willing to do this, it seems to be young majority of the time. But and I think we have to have a large conversations, which we are having right now. We're having this conversation about mental illness and how do we handle it. We've got this terrible opioid addiction going on in our culture right now. We worked on some legislation in the state house to do that. I would work on that in the federal level too.
So it's not about access to firearms?
It's about access to firearms for somebody who is mentally ill. We need to absolutely make sure that we already have a lot of laws in place on background checks. We already have a lot of laws in place on what kind of guns you can and cannot own. We need
to make sure. Do you think those laws are working?
We need to enforce them. We need to enforce them.
Mm-hmm. How would you go about making sure that happens as a member of Congress?
I would encourage the state and local authorities to look at what's on the books and use what's there. Use what's there. And then if we have a conversation in the future where those are inadequate, I would listen. But right now we have lots of laws on the books that I think we need to enforce.
Mike Miller, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, this was great, Matthew. Thank you for having me.
Up next on Intersection.
I'm somebody whose life is a reflection of an opportunity at the American dream. I'm a refugee, an immigrant, the first Vietnamese-American woman ever elected to Congress.
Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy joins us for a look back at her first term and what she hopes to achieve if she wins re-election. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Democrat Stephanie Murphy is finishing up her first term in office, and she wants to hold on to her seat in Florida's 7th Congressional District, facing a challenge from Republican Mike Miller. Murphy touts her credentials working across the aisles to get things done, and she cites the endorsement of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a rarity for a Democratic candidate, as evidence of her pragmatic approach to the job.
Well, Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
This is an interesting time to be a Democrat in Congress. What has that first term been like for you?
The first term has been really interesting. I have found, though, that even though I serve as a Democrat, deep in the minority in my first term, I have been able to get quite a bit done. But I've been able to get a lot done because I've found other people to work with in a bipartisan manner. And so I've been named the most effective member of my freshman class, as well as the 7th most bipartisan member of the entire Congress. And I think those two things go hand in hand.
Who are your allies on the other side of the aisle?
Well, it just depends on what I work on. But within Florida, our delegation works really well together on a lot of issues. And I've worked with Carlos Curbelo on a number of issues. I've also worked with Brian Fitzpatrick in Pennsylvania on a number of law and order types of issues. It just really depends on what the topic is.
That aside, there is so much partisan politics right now in Congress. And we saw that come to the forefront with the hearings for Justice Kavanaugh, now Supreme Court Justice. To what extent does that represent the way things get done in Congress? And do you think there is a real kind of fissure in Congress that needs to be bridged? And if so, how do you get back to a more bipartisan way of working?
I think, let me just first say that watching the third branch that's supposed to be nonpartisan impartial. Watching the Kavanaugh hearings go down the way they did was deeply disappointing as somebody who loves this country and believes in our democracy and believes that the judicial branch should be nonpartisan. I think there's enough partisanship when it comes to the executive branch and the legislative branch. And so that was deeply disappointing to me. But as it relates to partisanship, I think sometimes it takes leaders willing to reach across the aisle, willing to lead by example, willing to work together to make the fissure better. And the reality is that I think the people I represent, Central Floridians, don't walk around saying to themselves, oh, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican or I'm a no-party affiliate. They just think about themselves as Americans. And I think their elected leaders should also think about themselves as Americans first and do what's right for our country and our constituents as opposed to worrying too much about party politics.
Some of the issues that you're quoted as saying are important to you include jobs, security, and making sure that everyone has a fair shot at success. That's, you know, you hear that from a lot of politicians, but let's start with jobs. How do you make sure that Central Floridians in particular are getting the right kinds of jobs and enough of those jobs are coming here?
You know, I'd just like to remind your listeners that the reason those things are at the center of what I'm focused on is that I'm somebody whose life is a reflection of an opportunity at the American dream. I'm a refugee, an immigrant, the first Vietnamese-American woman ever elected to Congress. I've had the opportunity to work hard and have a fair shot at the American dream, and I deeply believe in making sure that that's still available for Central Floridians who I represent, as well as all Americans across this country. And so I begin my job by listening, and I'm hearing from my constituents as well, concerns around jobs, you know, an economy that works for everyone, well-paying jobs with quality benefits. That's sort of at the heart of how you get to caring for your family and making sure that everybody has a fair shot at that American dream.
Some things must be going right, though, because the unemployment rate is quite low at the moment. It's hard for a lot of firms to hire because, you know, there are so many people who have jobs now. So some things that are happening must be heading in the right direction.
You hear a lot about these statistics about the stock market and the unemployment, but when you talk to average Americans, they are feeling the crunch of wage stagnation. So while they are employed and have the dignity of a full-time job, they don't quite have the dignity of being able to afford to take care of their families and pay for healthcare costs and to pay for rising costs of education. And we're about to see the impacts of the tariffs and the trade war that just got started on consumer products. And so I think your average American feels disconnected from those high-level macroeconomic statistics because here in Central Florida, one in five workers makes $20,000 or below. It's hard to take care of a family on that kind of salary.
So as a member of Congress, what can you do? Like, it's, you know, there are many things that you could do, but what are some of the steps that you can take to make sure that wages do start to rise and that some of those other things like healthcare can be paid for? Transportation might factor into that as well. What are the things you are doing and what else can you do?
Well, it is about making sure that we have an economy that works for everyone with well-paying jobs and quality benefits. And so I'm a supporter of a $15 minimum wage with a gradual approach to getting there. And I also have been a part of a group of bipartisan members who have looked at healthcare and have set aside the rhetorical repeal and replace, where there's no real plan for replace. We've set aside that rhetoric and just said, okay, what do we need to do to address the healthcare system that we have today? Because prices are going up. And so we put together some proposals that through the Problem Solvers Caucus. Unfortunately, in the hyperpartisan environment that we are dealing with as it relates to healthcare, those proposals haven't gotten the kind of attention, I think, and an opportunity on the House floor as they should have. But we have to keep working at those things because I hear from too many constituents that their premiums are going up, or small businesses who are getting their notification that the cost of insurance is going up. And I hear from seniors who are making a very tough decision between whether or not they can afford their groceries or they can afford their prescription drugs. So we have to start fixing the problem today instead of playing political games with the healthcare system.
So what is something you could do right now to make that happen?
Well, I think there are a number of things that you can do to address, say, prescription drug costs. So
sure.
We could allow Medicare to directly negotiate the drug prices. We can also increase transparency in drug pricing, and that's a proposal that I've supported where if a drug company inflates or its drug prices significantly, it has to explain why that happens. I mean, if you think about the EpiPen situation, this kind of holds people more accountable, creates transparency in pricing so that we don't have price gouging when it comes to prescription medicines.
Well, let me just come back to the idea of negotiating drug pricing, though. When you say allow Medicare to negotiate, you mean allow the federal government to negotiate pricing?
Yes.
Is that a non-starter, though? I mean, what kind of buy-in do you have from the Republican side for that?
You know, it's hard to have this conversation with Republicans because we can't get them past the laser-like focus on repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act and getting down to brass tactics of actually fixing the three-part system that we have, which includes Medicare and Medicaid, employer-based healthcare in the individual market. So, you know, that's what I mean when I say we can't play partisan politics. We have to set aside the talking points and actually start talking about what we can do as a country and as electeds to make this system work for everyone.
But you do have Republicans in that group of problem solvers.
Yes.
So you do have the ear of some of them, right?
Some of them.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, it takes leadership too, right? So there have been... The way that the House works is whoever is in leadership controls what comes to the floor. And in our case, it's been this last Congress, it's been a Republican-held House. And so many of these proposals never even get a chance to see the light of day. That's the reason I've joined the problem solvers in their break the gridlock proposal. Basically, we're holding our vote for Speaker hostage to some changes to the House rules so that if a bill has bipartisan support and significant bipartisan support, it gets a chance to come to the House floor and that it doesn't just require leadership's judgment as to whether or not a bill gets a vote.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking to U.S. Representative Stephanie Murphy. Congresswoman, I want to ask you, too, about leadership then. Your opponent in this race has criticized you for loyalty to Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader. Is she the right person to be leading the minority, do you think?
I'm somebody who has been recognized by outside groups as being one of the most independent members of Congress, the seventh most bipartisan, the most effective in my freshman class. Our local paper has called me a get-the-job-done pragmatist.
You're talking about the Orlando Sentinel?
Yes. And so even the Chamber of Commerce has endorsed me for my bipartisan approach to supporting small businesses and growing our economy. And so the attack that my opponent wants, his strategy is basically to say Nancy Pelosi as many times as he can when it in reference to me. But it just doesn't ring true. All these other outside organizations have basically agreed that I am not somebody, that I'm somebody who serves this community and does so effectively in a bipartisan way.
Let me ask then, Congresswoman Murphy, about one of the other things you talk about in your campaign, security. National security, I guess that's something that you'll hear people talk about in terms of border security particularly. What is your policy there and how do you go about making sure that the country is safe?
When it comes to security, I think about it in both terms of keeping America safe from foreign and domestic threats. And so on the foreign threat front, I think we need to have strong and smart national security foreign policy that keeps us safe here at home. As it relates to border security, you know, as a former national security specialist, I know that there is a way for us to have a comprehensive immigration reform that allows us to secure our borders, grow our economy, and still stay true to our American values. And I'm not seeing, I'm seeing a lot more rhetoric that isn't conducive to addressing real threats as opposed to sort of political partisan politics.
What are the threats you want to see addressed?
Well, as it relates to foreign policy, I think we have to be very careful as to how we deal with countries that are seeking nuclear weapons. So that's North Korea, Iran. When it relates to domestic security, I think we have to address the issue of gun violence in our country. And I'm proud to say that that was one of the things that was a priority for me in this last Congress. And I was able to lead an initiative to lift the 22-year ban on gun violence research. And, you know, I think it's really important, no matter where you are on gun safety, we should all agree that we should be able to legislate from a place of fact. And allowing the federal government to study gun violence, one of our biggest public health issues, is an important step in the right direction.
It's such a polarizing issue, though, right? I mean, I'm sure a lot of people on the left and the right agree that on some aspects of it, but at the same time, how do you go about making change without infringing the Second Amendment? How do you get people who are so entrenched in their views to kind of see a different way through this?
I think that the imperative is there that we have to find some common ground on this, because too many people are losing their lives to gun violence in the United States.
But that imperative has been there for a long time.
Absolutely. And what I believe, though, is that if we start from a place of fact, maybe we can cut through the polarizing rhetoric and find some common ground. But we must be able to find some common ground on common sense gun safety measures that protects the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens while preventing the most dangerous individuals from gaining access to the most dangerous weapons.
One more thing I wanted to ask you about is education, because it kind of keys into the idea of getting everybody a good chance of success. What, if you're re-elected to Congress, will you do to promote the kind of education that people need to set them on the career paths they need to get that chance of success?
Education is incredibly personally important to me. My access to public education was the single factor that changed the course of my life and opened all sorts of doors for me. And so I want to make sure that this generation and the generations to come have access to quality education opportunities. It's one of the reasons why, in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, I led an initiative to create an emergency education fund for school systems much like ours, where we were recipients of hurricane-displaced students. Here in Orange County and Seminole County, we received thousands of new students. And I wanted to make sure that those school systems had the resources they need to accommodate the new students without negatively impacting the existing students. And I'm proud to say that we were able to, for Florida, it was about $100 million of emergency education funding. So that kind of addresses the immediate thing. As to what I would be interested in working on if I were to be reelected, I think we really have to look at our education system and make sure that we serve everyone, no matter what zip code that you're born into. And also, as you think about higher education, there's a McKinsey study out there that says when you ask schools if they feel like they prepare a student for the workforce, they'll answer at 70-some percent yes. And then when you ask the employers, do you feel like the schools have prepared the students to be workers, they answer at some 40-some percent. So there's this clear gap between what schools are preparing people for and what companies need. We need to be able to try to close that gap a bit. And, you know, Gartner says that 6 of the 10 jobs that will be in existence in 10 years don't exist today. So are we making the changes that we need to in our education system? Are we teaching students the right things and preparing them for the labor force that they're going into?
Congresswoman Stephanie Murphy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Find us online at wmfe.org/intersection. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. We're in the first week of our fall silent drive. That means we take just a little time out of the programs you listen to every day to remind you of the value of listener support. We're committed to more programming and less intrusive fundraising, so if you value the local programs and podcasts you hear, like Intersection, Spotlight, Are We There Yet?, and in-depth reporting on healthcare, the environment, the arts, and politics from Abe Abariah, Amy Green, Danielle Pryor, Nicole Darden-Creston, and Emily Lang, make a pledge of support. Become a sustaining member today and we'll send you a pair of exclusive 90.7 WMFE custom socks. Help your favourite public radio station keep your feet warm and look cool at the same time. Call 1-800-785-2020 or visit WMFE.org. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.